Welcome to the Inside Data Center podcast. I'm Andy Davis, and in this podcast, I will interview the people working in the data center sector and tell their stories. If you are working in the DC sector or you are looking to work in the sector, then this is the podcast for you. Welcome to the Inside Data Center podcast. Today, I'm joined by Guy Wilner, CEO and chairman of iAccelerate and iX Africa. Afternoon, Guy.
Afternoon.
How you doing?
Very good, thank you, considering all our lockdown shenanigans.
That's it, another lockdown here in the UK, so we're getting used to it now, though, I think. thanks for coming on today. One reason why I was quite keen to get you on is a lot of conversations that I have on these and with clients and alike is around emerging markets. Obviously, I know that you're very active in what would be classed as sort of emerging regions. Do you just want to give everyone a quick introduction of who you are and what you're up to at the moment?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've been in the data center industry since 1998, so I've been around the block a bit started off building a business in Western Europe, France, UK, Germany, Switzerland, and trying to float it in 2000 and obviously pulling the float on London Stock Exchange during the dot-com bubble bursting.
Perfect timing. Yeah,
which is great fun. Yeah, it was very busy times. But we managed to survive and literally drilled down and got costs as near to zero as possible. And as a result, we survived with the help of a couple of our investors as well and pulled through and ended up acquiring some of our competitors who'd gone bankrupt during that period. So about 75% of our competitors went bankrupt post-dot-com bubble. So it was pretty awful, you know, big companies writing off billions of, or at least hundreds of millions of pounds of investments that had just vanished into thin air. So we started picking up data centers. I remember picking up a data center in Munich, which KPN Quest had spent 60 million euros building. And we paid a token euro for it in return for taking on the warehouse lease from the building owner who didn't know what to do with all of this weird data center stuff. So we promptly put 50,000 servers for Google in that one, and that paid the rent and maintenance and carried on from there. And same in Frankfurt, we had a massive building there, and the building was so enormous there was an indoor karting track at one end of the campus, which was still going for a number of years.
For the staff, I guess.
Well, yeah, you sort of kind of think that in the beginning, and then it doesn't really materialize.
The novelty wears off. Yeah.
I remember when we bought the Frankfurt campus. It was such a big campus. It was quite a few acres, about 5 hectares, I think. And so I then went on eBay and bought a little electric golf cart for our general manager in Germany and had it delivered. But of course, as a good German, you know, being focused on facts and stuff, he phoned me up and said, "I've received this golf cart. What purpose does it serve?"
And I don't play golf.
That's right. So it was only the English construction guys who used to whiz around and try and slide around and in the snow with it. And then we sort of built that up, and then we floated on AIM, on the secondary market of London Stock Exchange, in 2006. And so that was our final sort of, you know, we got our own back, got the business on the market. And but we've been going for about 9 years by then. So Equinix and AT&T and Savvis started taking a look at us. And we brought Lazard in, some friends at Lazard who were fantastic. And they ran the whole process, and Equinix took us over. And so in September 2007, we rebranded everything. I became president of Europe, which is very nice, and at least for a while. And in about June 2008, myself and my co-founder, we both sort of felt we ought to move on and let Equinix run the show with all the VPs that we had in our business. So we left in June 2008. At that point, I joined the board of Taraco in South Africa, where a friend of mine, Tim Parsonson, was building his evil plans to build a data center empire in South Africa. And I invested money in it and joined the board, and that was great fun. And I was on the board until 2014, when we sold the business to Permira. And then after that, Well, during that period, actually in 2010, I started looking at Russia. I was invited by EBRD to take a look at a project in Russia. And I'd never been there. I'd lived in Hungary and Austria a little bit, and when I was working in Paris with Philips doing software development. But never Russia. So I thought, well, that could be fun. So I went out there and took a look and thought, well, this shouldn't be difficult to raise money for. But it took me 2 years. I brought the World Bank in, IFC, because they're already investors in Teraco in South Africa, and got it moving. A couple of years later, my co-founder died of a heart attack at the age of 53. And he was kind of my Mr. Russia guy. He was an English guy, but lived 25 years in Russia. So suddenly I had this business on my hands, lost my business partner, and I don't speak Russian. It was tricky, but we pulled through again. And we brought in Sumitomo Corporation as one of the investors, and then later on Goldman Sachs. And now we're Goldman Sachs' biggest investment in Russia. And that business has grown and grown since we kind of opened in 2013, I guess, our first data center opened. And the first one we opened was a diddy little sort of bit at the end of a warehouse. And now that warehouse is full and looks small compared to the second one next to it, which is also full. And we're planning on building a new one adjacent on another plot of land. And we're just announcing Europe's largest campus in South Moscow, where we got 34 acres to play around with there. So we could potentially squeeze up to 200 megawatts on that one. So we've gone from being, a little startup in Russia, kind of number 11 in the market, to now number two after Rostelecom, the flag carrier. And that, you know, brings its associated responsibilities. You know, it's a big company now, and we've got a lot of customers and a lot of business and lots of hypercloud, which we didn't expect, you know, a few years ago. And then as a side hustle, we'd been looking at Kenya with Teraco for a while, and then we dropped it, and then we picked it up, and then we dropped it, and then Sumitomo was interested, and then they dropped it, and I thought, well, sod it, I'll just do it, because we've been looking so long, we just might as well do this. So we found an absolutely lovely family in Kenya who has a perfect piece of land. They're co-investing with us. The guys there, actually, one of the guys is a certified electrical engineer doing all sort of medium power engineering and stuff, so absolutely perfect. And with another local investor and a French investor, we've kicked off. But as it took about 5 years to develop that project, it's moved from being originally a kind of retail co-location focused business to being an all-out hyperscale data center campus. So we're trying to do like Ascenti in Brazil or like AirTrunk in Australia did, just basically go in there and pick up some very big hyperscale deals first, and then we can always bring in the retail customers afterwards. So that's kind of what we're doing in Kenya now. So that's kind of four data center projects in since 1998. Yeah,
it's a whistle stop tour of your career.
Yeah.
Very good. What I always like to do, just quickly before we touch on kind of what it's like working in, you know, Russia and alike, is just go back to the beginning of your career. I saw you did a degree at Oxford Brookes University in engineering. Absolutely. Always quite interested to see what drew you into engineering.
Oh gosh, I mean, my parents are both artists. They both studied fine art at the Slade School of Art, so couldn't be more different. No, but I think, you know, they were always penniless, and so we were always sort of thinking, oh gosh, you know. And so I was thinking of being an archaeologist, and I thought, actually, don't get paid very much doing that. And I think it did influence it. And we're all mad about cars, all the brothers, so we all became variously sort of mechanics and engineers, with my poor sister holding and carrying the baton for art and fashion. So we got into engineering on a very practical basis. We had a lovely old workshop. We'd fiddle around and, you know, with a vice and the hacksaw and stuff, making stuff all the time. So that was quite fun. So I guess that's what brought me into engineering. Went to Oxford Brookes. I was expecting much higher of myself, but I was also playing in a band at the time. Not particularly well and not particularly brilliant band. But anyway, it obviously, you know, used a lot of my time up. And so my A-level results were appalling. And I went to Oxford Brookes, got a place, deferred it for a year so that I could mature a bit, and then took a year off and sort of, you know, and didn't go to sort of you know, uncle's farm in New Zealand. I actually got myself a job working in a little factory in a tiny little town called Prince's Risborough in the UK, where I was staying in a bed and breakfast during the week and working in this little factory building control panels for air compressors. And I also had a spell feeding cows at a grassland research institute, which is great fun. And then turned up at Oxford Brookes, which is a fantastic degree. It was really good. A lot of spoon feeding because, you know, if you haven't done well in your A-levels, it's good if you get a bit of spoon feeding. So lots and lots of lessons. Morphed from, it was a general engineering degree, so morphed from general engineering, design, mechanical, then to electrical, then slowly to electronic, and then finally in assembly language programming, which I actually really enjoyed. And armed with my amazing success at writing about a quarter of a page of assembly language, I then got a job in Paris writing assembly language of Philips, and I was given a 500-page program to debug, which is slightly beyond me, I think.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it wasn't in French as well.
No, luckily not.
And when did you first enter the data center industry?
So that was when I was at I was in cable TV, which was always a weird business. We called it Planet Cable after a while because it had its completely different economics from any reality. It was always a struggle in the UK. But in this cable TV business that I was employed in, I've been brought back from France by a French investment company that was building cable TV networks in the UK, near London area and in Yorkshire. And I was doing overlay telecom, so I was doing overlay fiber networks in the ducts that they used to put their cable TV signals down. So we ended up building a sort of B2B overlay business telecoms company and started selling network to people like Marks and Spencer and British Airways, which was very exciting. And but then we also started looking at building a data center. I'd seen that Telehouse had been building in East London, in Docklands, and that'd been hugely successful. It had started off as a disaster recovery site for banks, with 16, I think, Japanese banks having shares in the business. The idea was during the sort of the Northern Ireland troubles, they were worried about bombs in London. So they had these disaster recovery suites in Telehouse in Docklands. And luckily the whole trouble sort of calmed down, and also telecoms deregulation hit. So suddenly Telehouse found itself housing telephone exchanges for people like Mercury Telecoms and then dozens of other telcos. So I could see that was a successful business, but there was only one site in the UK. And I thought, well, if that goes down, then the whole of the internet goes down. And so we should have a West London Telehouse as well. And as my cable TV business was in West London, Slough, then I thought, well, okay, well, why don't we build one there? So I talked to the board of my company, and they were interested, but the company was being sold. And a few months later, we were sold. And so I thought, well, this is my opportunity. Why don't I just have a look? So that was kind of February 98. So I started faffing about and trying to produce some sort of PowerPoint show for to build a data center. And I started phoning up investment funds, literally finding their names and phoning them and saying, I need £2 million to build a data center in West London. And they weren't particularly interested. And then a friend of mine said, no, you've got to ask for 20 and they'll take you seriously. So I asked for 20 and they were very polite and they started getting interested. And but they started talking about things like business plans, and which I didn't know what that was. And I bumped into a friend, a French friend, or rather I've sort of made friends with a French friend in Fulham where I lived, and gradually reeled him in, and he became part of my team. So basically there was two of us, and he was very much finance guy from a top business school in France, whereas I was the engineering business development guy. He was finance operations. So we pushed on with our little plan and wrote a business plan and then raised money in July 99, we had £10 million come in for what was essentially a PowerPoint show.
So there you go. There's a lesson there, I'm sure. You take. I guess it's a lesson in risk taking, educated risk taking.
No, I think there's a lot of. I mean, that's what I always say about being an entrepreneur is that if you're If you intellectualize too much, you'll never do anything. You know, if you try and weigh up the fors and against or whatever for any of these decisions, it's obvious that, you know, it's nutty, massively high risk, and could ultimately fail. That's partly why you don't really want entrepreneurs in politics, because entrepreneurs do take massive risks, and perhaps that's not what you want to do if you're a politician.
Yeah, indeed. They're probably not best time to talk about politics either.
Yeah, I think we'll steer clear of that.
Yeah, I think we'll avoid that conversation. But no, that's really interesting though, that how you first entered it, because obviously entering it as an entrepreneur as opposed to as a career is a totally different sort of entry into the sector, and the majority of people have obviously not experienced it from that perspective.
Yeah, it was literally from nothing, and that's quite fun. But I do realize now, like doing my Kenyan one, which is essentially my fourth venture, my third real one that I've started up and the fourth one I've been involved in. And it is hard, because every time you do start a business from nothing, it really is. It's you know, it's a big, big struggle. And one of the biggest struggles is getting the human side right, building the team up. That's a really, you know, so it can take years. It can take 6 or 7 years just to get the business to some sort of stable point where it functions.
Yeah, I was going to touch on that as well, like culturally as well, which is something I was going to talk to you about when we talk about sort of our accelerator, which we can obviously do now. But when you entered into the Russian market, I'm sure it was very different to what it looks like now. But culturally, it must be significantly different as well to start developing a, not just starting a job in that country, but developing a successful business in that country.
Well, I think, you know, from IX Europe, when we had France, UK, Germany, Switzerland, I think we had a pretty good baptism in that. I mean, dealing with a conflict between a Swiss-French person and a Swiss-German person is probably far more difficult than dealing with a Russian oligarch, I should think. So,
yeah.
So I know it's what not, but, you know, but to be fair, the one thing that we did when Christoph and I, my business partner and I, were running IX Europe was have a massive respect for culture in each country and for people's roots and where they come from and what they do and how things are done. And the idea of sort of railroading in and saying, this is how you need to do it, this is the blueprint, you know, it doesn't work. And in the very early days, in the sort of mid-90s, there was a company called Colt Telecom, City of London Telecom, that had just started up in London. And it became an amazing runaway success, was amazingly successful across Europe in those early days. One of the reasons why it was very successful is because it had this kind of laissez-faire attitude to its different country managers. It said, look, you know, we're a financial services telecoms network, go and make it happen. And they made it happen in different ways, but as a result, they doubled their growth. Whereas if you try and make it happen from the center, you're always restricting growth. So that's kind of what we did across Europe with IX Europe, and that was my attitude with Russia. A lot of respect for what's being done, and working with the team. So as a result, you know, we've now got about 105 staff in Moscow, and there is not one foreigner in that 105 currently in Moscow. Some have, you know, maybe a couple of passports, but everybody's a Russian national in the business, which says something. You know, it's taken us a long time to build that team there.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to have that local knowledge as well, isn't it? You know, culturally it's important, but also the local knowledge that they can bring you and the value they can add from just knowing the region and knowing the geography and how to do business in that country.
Yeah, and I think that the whole thing about being an entrepreneur is, you know, you can be slightly naive and you can sort of go for it, but you've always got to be careful of arrogance sort of creeping in, you know, and I know better and whatever. So you're constantly trying to just talk to people and say, what do you think, you know, and hearing a lot of people saying, oh, you're mad, you know, you shouldn't do that or whatever. But there is some logic in some things that people say. And, you know, typically in Russia, for example, the foreigner will come in and want to expedite stuff because everything takes ages. You know, well, I'll just expedite it. And a well-meaning Russian will say, well, OK, right, we'll pay this guy $500 and we'll pay this guy $1,000 and we'll get it because this foreigner wants stuff done quickly. And I'm a bit embarrassed it's done slowly. Whereas actually, if you just follow the process, it might be a bit Kafkaesque because they haven't, you know, changed everything since Soviet times. If you just follow the process and go to the right queue in the right tax office or whatever, then you will get what you need and everything gets done properly and you haven't paid anybody off and you can sleep at night.
Exactly. And on Russia as well, as a region, there's not a lot of publicity about development in Russia. I see, obviously, the stuff that you post and the projects you're up to. What's the market like at the moment in Russia? Is it rapidly developing across the country?
Yes, it is. Russia's a highly urbanized population. There's 12 cities with more than a million population. It's pretty chilly in winter, so, you know, they're online a lot. Very highly educated. The education system's, you know, very, very, very high level, very good quality. I think 60% of graduates in Moscow are technical graduates. So there's a lot of technical expertise in Russia. And and it's a big market. It's the biggest internet market in Europe. It's bigger than Germany. And you've got one jurisdiction, so 11 time zones. So it's a very big, very busy market. It's its own market. It's not China, because obviously China's, you know, seven times as big. But it has some similarities with China in the sense that it's got its own ecosystem. So, you know, eBay and Amazon are not present in Russia. AliExpress is. But then you've got people like unknown companies like Ozone, a small online retail company, which just happened to float on NASDAQ in November, and it has a market cap of $10 billion. And there's probably, you know, a couple of dozen of those companies in Russia in different verticals. You know, Headhunter's another one, which is the leading jobs board. Anybody looking for a job, they go on headhunter.ru. Again, floated on NASDAQ in May 2019. It's done very well. So there's Wildberries, another one, which is, again, another sort of Amazon eBay contender. So there's a lot going on in Russia, but you don't see it very much because, you know, partly because of the sanctions issued, that a lot of these Russian-born tech companies obviously had difficulty spreading from Russia, specifically after the sanctions, because they kind of, you know, weren't very well viewed. I think Wildberries is now beginning to open in Germany and is looking at France and Italy soon. So there is stuff going on. And Avito, I think, is another one that's looking at international expansion. Yandex has international expansion, a lot in emerging markets, interestingly. So it's a market that's just totally overlooked. And as a country, it's kind of overlooked, because if you get the map of Europe or you get the map of Asia, you don't tend to see Russia. So, you know, you sort of say, okay, so let's look at the European market. Oh, no, Russia's not there. Let's look at the Asian market. Oh, Russia's not there. Right. Okay. So where does it sit? And this is the interesting thing, but it's a very big and, very vibrant market.
I guess where it does sit geographically puts it central to the Asian region and the European region from a customer perspective as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at Russia, actually, and you sort of look under the lid a little bit, there's something like 100 different nationalities there. There's all sorts of different people from different races. You know, something up to 12% Muslim in the country. You've got everything from, you know, frozen tundra to beautiful grapevines, you know, bathing in the sun. There's so much variety. You go to some of these train stations in Moscow and you can just see the racial variety just by looking at people walking across the train station. It's fascinating. And it is, you realize it is kind of Europe, but it's Europe transposed quite a few thousand kilometers east. And so there's much more of an Eastern influence than you would see in Western Europe.
Yeah, and building data centers in these regions as well. I'm assuming that, you know, the challenge of constructing in Russia is different to the challenge you would have in Kenya or Greece or Frankfurt. Is each country offer different challenges?
There are. I mean, there are obviously different challenges. The data center construction industry is kind of dominated by Western companies at the moment. So one of the issues we're having to face is with sort of increasing pressure on ourselves, generated by ourselves, about sustainability, where we want to really focus on sustainability of our builds as well as our operations. We're looking much more at local supply. How far does this window have to come from? You know, if I'm in Nigeria, why do I buy windows from Germany? You know, if I'm in Germany, I wouldn't be buying windows from Nigeria. So, you know, is there a local source? Ah, no, because the engineer specified a double skin roof or whatever. Well, do we really need a double skin roof? Because there's a guy down the road who does single skin roofs, which are fantastic. And there's an alternative to, you know, then we can put some other sort of liner on it. And that's what they're looking at in a project in Nigeria at the moment. So if you're a little bit more flexible, then you can find more local supply. So our hot and cold corridors, for example, are Russian made now delivered locally. And we're trying to get more and more of that done. Same with our Kenya project. You know, Schneider does some construction fabrication work in Kenya, and hopefully we'll get some locally produced product as well.
Yeah, it must be getting easier to source it locally as well, I guess, as these countries are upskilled than it was, say, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, it is. It's much easier now. It's much easier now. That's clear. And people have got, you know, and take Kenya as an example. I can find construction companies that have recently fitted out a data center, so they know what it looks like. If I'd arrived there 5 or 6 years ago, then it would have been a different story.
I would say, I think 5 or 6 years ago in the UK, not a lot of people knew what a data center was anyway. So it gives you an idea of what it must be like in the emerging markets as a comparison.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I remember when we floated on AIM on the secondary market in London in 2006, even the analysts who I was talking to from the banks didn't even know what data center was. You know, they'd say, they came out with all sorts of funny comments. And then I thought, okay, sod this. I find this all too depressing. And I found some contact at Goldman Sachs in New York, some junior person there, and said, I'm coming out. Can I come and see some investors there? And he said, oh, a great idea. I'll get you out there. So we'll get up. So, you know, I arrived in New York. He got me a limousine waiting for me. They drove me around all these investment funds in Madison Avenue, all talking about data centers. And actually, when I arrived in New York and I took my cab to town, the taxi driver said, oh, what are you doing? I said, data centers. Oh, right, data centers. Yeah. And I thought, right, okay. Ah, finally, somebody gets it.
You could do that, genuinely do that in the UK now, and I reckon the majority of people wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, until my youngest daughter, until she was 8, she wouldn't talk about her dad's job at school because she thought I ran a dating centre. She was quite embarrassed about that.
One thing I was going to ask you, funnily, is on the branding of the industry, because it's something I'm quite big on, to get the exposure out there and, you know, really tell people more about what we do. And funny puns like that are actually one of the best ways to get the brand out there, you know. But what do you think the industry can do to sort of just generate more exposure?
It's a tricky one because, you know, right in the beginning of the industry, we're saying, you know, my addressable market is like 10,000 companies. That's all I want to talk to. I don't want to be known by anybody else. You know, if you look at one of the biggest ones, Equinix, they're still not known in the US. Equinox, the gyms are. So any employee of Equinix, which has a market cap of something like $65 billion now, so it's bigger than most UK banks, any employee there tells their friends that they work at Equinix, and their friends will say, oh, yeah, Equinox, yeah, I'll go to that gym down the road. So they're totally unknown still outside the tech sector, and I just don't know whether we'll ever be known. Obviously, it's a bit more visible now because of the energy consumption issues, the sustainability issues around this. And obviously, you know, Microsoft and Google make a lot of noise about their data centers as well.
Yeah, it's definitely coming more to the fore, isn't it? But I know exactly what you mean. I think it's one of those things, if you're interested in it, you know about it. If you don't really need to, then you're never going to see anything from a news perspective because you're just not looking for it.
That's right, exactly.
Just before I let you go, I just got one last question on emerging markets, really. Is there anywhere particular that you can see sort of significant growth coming in the next couple of years?
Well, I mean, you know, the interesting story about emerging markets in general is winding it right back to the late 80s when I was working with Philips in Paris. We used to get these weekly news sheets, you know, printed and talking to us about various different technologies. And one was about GSM, digital mobile phones, replacing analog phones. And some very experienced analysts saying, well, of course, digital mobile will never catch on in sub-Saharan Africa because they just don't have the disposable income. So we estimate that it'll be, and it was usual sort of analyst stuff, it was like 22.3% penetration or something, you know. So only 22.3% of the population will ever have a mobile because these. And the second one was that it will never be cheaper. It will never cost less than $250 in cost to make a digital mobile phone. So, I mean, these days you could probably get them for about $5. So all these sort of pontificating stuff, and then you kind of think about it, there, you know, in any emerging market, be that Myanmar, you know, Chile, Russia, wherever, there are people who communicate, who use technology, who have mobile phones and tablet phones and iOS and Java and whatever, and, you know, everything. And therefore, you will have the proportionate amount of data centers in all of those countries. So we're faced not with a potential market, but with an inevitability that data center will reach those countries. So it's just a question of when.
Yeah, and I guess from an entrepreneur's or a developer's perspective, it's a case of timing, isn't it?
Yeah. Timing is everything in this market, and especially if you're in an emerging market, because your cost of capital is massively high. So, you know, if I'm building in Switzerland, I'm practically being given the money to build. So I can put a beautiful door handle on the door that's cost me $100, and I can borrow that, borrow the $100, and I'm paying 0.25% interest. So every year I'm just paying cents for interest. If I'm in sub-Saharan Africa, Russia, you know, potentially Brazil, somewhere like that, maybe I'm up paying 10% interest. So every year I look at that door handle and it's cost me $10. So if nobody uses that door handle for 4 years, it's cost me $40 before somebody actually opens the door. I can't afford to build large amounts of data center and let it sit there empty. I have to build to suit, you know, and so it's much more complicated building an emerging market.
Yeah, makes total sense. Before I let you go then, just one question I ask everybody on my podcast, just to get their idea really. But if there's one piece of advice you'd give anyone looking to work in the data center industry, what would it be?
I'd say read up and benchmark, and try not to invent stuff yourself. But, you know, if ever you're trying to research something, just there's so much information out there. And a lot of it's been thought through many, many times already. So there's so much you can benchmark in the industry today.
Great advice. And I totally agree. There is a lot, like I said earlier, there's a lot to be found if you look for it. I think it's just, you've got to look for it a lot of the time. Yeah. But okay, I really appreciate your time today, Guy. I think that's been great. I think we've got some good value. Obviously, learn about your career and your developments and get some good advice on working in the industry in different markets.
Well, thanks very much, Andy.
No, pleasure. I really appreciate your time.